Yoga in America.
In her second book, Indra Devi even talks more extensively about the subtle body, and you can see that culture is kind of opening up to these elements of yoga. And at the same moment, Aldous Huxley is starting to really promote hallucinogens, what we know as psychedelic drugs, and he called mind manifestors, pretty ardently.
That's Stephanie Simon. We talk with her about the story of yoga in America. Her book is The Subtle Body. And also, what does the WikiLeaks controversy mean for freedom on the internet?
Anybody who has been watching the way governments treat privileged information know that they were heading on a collision path with the internet. And WikiLeaks is just a glaring, glaring example of that.
That's Tim Carr of Free Press. We'll talk with him and with columnist Alexander Coburn about WikiLeaks. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. If you practice yoga or have tried it, what brought you to it? Were you looking for a spiritual practice, or did you just want to get into shape? Whether yoga is a religion for you, a spiritual discipline, or just a fitness routine, you'll be fascinated by Stephanie Simon's book, The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America. From Henry Thoreau, who Simon calls the first American yogi, to Indra Devi, who helped bring yoga to Hollywood, through Ram Dass and Allen Ginsberg's mixture of psychedelics and yoga, and on to Bikram Chowdhury and his hot yoga, Simon traces the story of America's love affair with this ancient Indian practice. My own grandmother, Ruth Alder, had a place in the story. She was Indra Devi's right-hand woman. A bit actress and dancer in Hollywood movies, my Nana found her true life's passion in her 50s when she went to India to study yoga. After helping Indra Devi ignite the yoga fitness craze, she taught yoga until her death at the age of 78. So when Simon's The Subtle Body came across my mental transom, I knew I had to talk with the author. Stephanie Simon has written for The Wall Street Journal, Rolling Stone, Vogue, and Yoga Journal. She's practiced the rigorous Ashtanga yoga for 15 years. I sat down with her this fall at the offices of her publishers, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. I started out by asking her, what is the subtle body?
Well, the subtle body, the one that I really refer to most, is the subtle body of Hatha Yoga, which is the circuit of chakras and nadis. The chakras are the energy centers that line the spine, starting at the floor of the pelvis up through the crown of the head, and the nadis are the channels through which the energy moves. And the point of Hatha Yoga is really to move energy up the chakras to the crown, the top chakra, which is called awakening kundalini.
And the subtle body, then, is like the body?
Well, it's not physical. You can't see it. You can't find it with a microscope. So I talk about it as sort of a functional metaphor, because while it's not visible, if you learn how to manipulate its energies, you're supposed to feel very specific results, and which have been detailed in yoga texts.
I was surprised to find that yoga actually came quite early to America, not in its form as a form of exercise, which is, I think, most of us think of yoga, but as a spiritual discipline.
Really, it was in the mid-19th century, and that moment was a moment when the transcendentalists, notably Ralph Waldo Emerson and Thoreau, we're really spending a lot of time reading Indian literature, Buddhist as well as what we think of as Hindu, and they were reading a lot of yoga texts. And Emerson was really fascinated by Indian philosophy and the sort of ideas of divinity that you would find in these works, especially the Bhagavad Gita. Thoreau was actually interested in practicing yoga, and some scholars believe he went to Walden to practice yoga, and I think it's a fairly credible case.
Actually taking the postures and the asanas?
No, the yoga that he was most interested in was not Hatha Yoga, which is the yoga of the postures, although that is a small part of Hatha Yoga. He was interested in the yoga of, which is much more meditative, and much of yoga writ large, it involves really learning to control the mind and is really centered on meditation. And even the postures of hatha yoga are towards sitting in long periods of meditation, traditionally. Their purpose was really not to achieve the perfect body, although certainly the purpose was to extend one's life.
So why do you think that Thoreau was the first American yogi?
I think the evidence suggests this for a couple of reasons. One, he definitely was enamored in books and books about yoga. Two, he had read these just prior to going to Walden. And he clearly, at Walden, was also trying to meditate. And there's both references to this in his works and references to this in his journals and his letters. And he referred to him once as an aspiring yogi. And then finally, you know, in his works, they're kind of littered with references to Indian scripture. So he was clearly trying to meditate. He was clearly trying to practice yoga as he understood it. But he really had a major obstacle, which was that he didn't have any Indian teachers. So he was essentially kind of making yoga up from what he could gather from these books, which are very coded and very difficult to decipher if you don't have a guru.
Yoga actually went through a time when it was not seen as something that was exactly respectable. Is that correct?
That's true. I think yoga had this sort of ambivalent status in America for quite some time. And part of that was this was a time where there were very few East Indians in the country. And number one, and there was a lot of racism still. This was not long after the Civil War. And another complicating factor for yoga, it was its greatest strength and its, in some ways its greatest weakness, was that women were often the biggest supporters of yoga. And really, it was their efforts that built the organizations around the swamis when they first came at the turn of the century. So you had respectable middle-class and upper-middle-class women associating with both yoga, which itself was considered somewhat dubious, certainly not Christian, and then forming intimate friendships and collegial relationships with these brown men. And that really set off all the moral alarm bells.
So tell us a little bit about these women and these brown men.
So, you know, an example of this would be Sarah Chapman Bull and Swami Vivekananda. Sarah Bull was always a very independent-minded woman. She married a man 40 years her senior when she was in her 20s. She had one child with him, a daughter. He was a musician from Norway, and he died when she was, you know, not too long after they were married. So she was widowed by 30. And she was from a very esteemed family in the Midwest and then settled in Cambridge. And she sort of became friends with a lot of the heirs to the Transcendentalists. And she herself had met Emerson. And when she met Swami Vivekananda in the summer of 1894, she became one of his biggest backers. Now, Swami Vivekananda had been a disciple of Sri Ramakrishna in India, a famous Indian yogi there. And he had come to the States the year before really not to teach yoga or anything of a spiritual nature. He had come to America to raise money because he wanted to help his countrymen. He wanted to help oppressed and downtrodden Indians. And he was kind of taking a page out of the missionary's handbook and saying, look, you know, we can do it just as well as you can. But he wasn't very good at fundraising, it turns out. But he did stay on. And in 1894, at a spiritual summer camp or spiritual retreat, really, called Greenacre, which Sarah Bull helped organize, Vivekananda started teaching yoga to small groups of Americans. And Sarah Bull had some contact with Indian thought before this, but it really was Swami Vivekananda that inspired her. And she spent the rest of her life supporting him, helping legitimize him, helping build his organization. And she even traveled to India and spent a year and a half there, right before the turn of the century in 1898, to spend more time with her guru, essentially, and to really steep herself more in yoga and to see India as well.
So when you're talking about yoga, what are we talking about here? Especially, what are we talking about yoga at that time? What is it?
Well, it's interesting because just about the moment that yoga starts taking off as a spiritual practice in America, within 5 years of this moment of it being introduced as a practice by Indian swamis, it splinters and there are internal schisms. So Swami Vivekananda, you know, sort of propounded what he called Raja Yoga, which is primarily a meditative and devotional practice. But he does talk about the subtle body and using your breath to control its energy. And he spends a lot of time on a practice called pranayama, which many people don't consider part of what is typically referred to as Raja Yoga, but he included it. So, but it did not, his yoga did not include the postures and did not include some of the more unusual internal purifications usually associated with Hatha Yoga, like threading a cloth through your digestive tract to clean it. And most of Americans were drawn to this, you know, again, a more devotional, meditative, contemplative type of yoga. So if you looked at a room of people practicing, you'd see women and men sitting in chairs with their eyes closed. You would maybe occasionally see someone sitting in lotus position, but not even that wasn't even required. A couple years later, a fellow Swami and disciple of Ramakrishna came, Swami Abhedananda, and he began teaching Hatha Yoga to Americans. And that included some postures, and that included breathing exercises, and that also included some of the internal purifications. And he really believed this was the only type of yoga that was appropriate for Americans, but Vivekananda, and by extension Sarah Bull, completely disagreed. And so there was a schism within Vivekananda's own organization by the turn of the century about which type of yoga was appropriate, even as Swami Abhedananda acquired a substantial following, one that could nearly rival Swami Vivekananda's at the time.
So a schism between those who emphasized postures and the body form of physicality and those who emphasized meditation and the breath.
Yes, pretty much. I mean, again, the purpose of both, they share the same goals, and some of, and in the way that Swami Vivekananda taught Raja Yoga, they same share many of the same underpinnings, theoretical, metaphysical underpinnings. But somehow doing the postures in particular was an offense to Vivekananda. And part of the reason was simply he was, according to some pretty good documentation, he wasn't very good at Hatha Yoga. He had tried it, and he himself wasn't a terribly physical person. Part of the reason was that that kind of use of the body wasn't considered as kind of having the body kind of roped to spiritual realization was still fairly foreign to Americans. That was, you know, people could relate to a more meditative form of yoga as something close to prayer. They really had a harder time understanding the relationship of the poses to spiritual realization. And furthermore, the poses were very, very closely linked with images of the yogi as a contortionist and a fakir and the sort of very negative stereotypes of Indian yogis and these horrible forms of asceticism. And finally, Hatha Yoga was more closely associated with obtaining psychic powers, which is not entirely fair because the other forms of yoga could get you there too if you read the scriptures. But Hatha Yoga in people's minds was much more associated with accruing strange powers.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Stephanie Simon about her book, The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America. And then came Hollywood, a real shift in the way yoga was seen.
Yes. Between the turn of the century and the middle of the century, a lot happened with yoga in America. And it kind of started, it spread far and wide, this more meditative form. But in the late 30s, a couple things happened. One, part of Swami Vivekananda's own organization, part of the Vedanta Society, there was an outpost of it in Hollywood run by a Swami named Swami Prabhavananda. And he kind of hewed to Vivekananda's line. He did not like Hatha Yoga, but he became quite popular among the literati of Hollywood, and that included a number of expatriate intellectuals, including Aldous Huxley and Christopher Isherwood. And their association with the Vedanta Society and the more devotional yoga taught there really made yoga much more respectable and kind of a little bit more in the public view than it had been. It had been popular, but it had been kind of dismissed at, you know, by many as a kind of preoccupation of middle-class ladies, so not taken so seriously. So the association and of Huxley and Isherwood, and they also were on the board of the Vedanta Society magazine, and so they were really involved in the organization, really did boost yoga's profile. In addition, a yoga teacher arrived named Indra Devi, and she came. She actually, her last stop had been China, but she was herself Russian, Swedish. And she'd been a student of the famed Hatha Yogi T. Krishnamacharya. And she had studied with him in Mysore, India. And she came to teach yoga in Hollywood. And she kind of quickly set up a school and attracted a very A-list of Hollywood stars, including people like Gloria Swanson and Jennifer Jones and Olivia de Havilland. And Devi herself was very devoted to yoga as a spiritual practice, but she kind of took the temperature of American culture at that moment, which was post-war America. This was in the late 40s and early 50s. And she decided that the yoga that Americans kind of could tolerate was a much more secular type of yoga. So she taught hatha yoga, and she really left out a lot of the mystical elements. She really didn't refer to the subtle body at all in her early teachings, at least not by name, and certainly not in her books. She focused on the poses and some simple breathing exercises. And by the mid-50s, this kind of yoga, which was, again, stripped of the sort of religious elements, was everybody's beauty secret in Hollywood. And so you'd see all these columns in the papers about how Gary Cooper uses yoga to relax, or this or that starlet, whose name we've long since forgotten, uses yoga to stay trim.
Right, and that in many ways is a place that yoga still resides today.
Yes, I think there are many, many parallels between the yoga yoga status in our culture of the middle 50s and yoga today. The difference is we went through the 60s in between, so there's a much more kind of full-blown, very spiritually focused kind of yoga still available in the States at ashrams and yoga centers throughout the country. But the dominance of that kind of yoga, the kind of yoga in which you really dedicate your whole life to it, it becomes more of a lifestyle than just something you do a few times a week. That really, peaked, as most people remember, in the 60s at that moment. And it was a moment that yoga was also very closely associated with psychedelic drugs. And in fact, you were starting to see the signs of this by the late 50s. In her second book, Indra Devi even talks more extensively about the subtle body. And you can see that culture is kind of opening up to these elements of yoga. And at the same moment, Aldous Huxley is starting to really promote hallucinogens, what we know as psychedelic drugs, and he called mind manifestors, pretty ardently. And he really had some powerful experiences on mescaline and on acid. And he wrote about them, and he wrote about when he wrote about them, famously in The Doors of Perception. He really said he compared his experiences with what the Eastern book said, because he had been steeped in Indian philosophy and yoga by this point. And one of my favorite discoveries was a Saturday Evening Post essay by Aldous Huxley that ran in 1958, in which he basically says that everyone should be doing psychedelic drugs. And this included acid at the time.
But at first, in some ways, they were rivals. When you have Tim Leary and Richard Alpert, who became Ram Dass, who parenthetically I'll say is my favorite guru in America, They at first saw psychedelics as a way to get what yoga is supposed to get you to, but a lot quicker.
Absolutely. And in fact, that was why Huxley thought every American should take these drugs, because he felt they were far more democratic than yoga. He felt that yoga was useful and could really alter your consciousness and deliver these ecstatic and liberating spiritual realizations and experiences, but he felt it was too hard for most people. So it is true that at the beginning, psychedelic drugs were seen as a replacement for yoga, essentially, and an easier way, more available to most people. But within a decade, people had realized, and including including Richard Alpert, who became Ram Dass, and people like Allen Ginsberg, that psychedelic drugs exacted a pretty high cost, and that what had started as kind of an analogous relationship, yoga and psychedelics, they got you to the same place, but different means, psychedelic drugs being more efficient, evolved. And in the kind of the middle of the decade, you really see the marriage of psychedelic drugs and yoga. So people are dropping acid and then going to the mantra rock dance that a swami presided over, and chanting and having these amazing experiences, or dropping acid and meditating on the chakras. By the end of the 60s, people, including Allen Ginsberg and including Ram Dass, are saying, you know, psychedelic drugs are useful. They give you a taste of the divine. But ultimately, yoga is a better way to get there.
Because it's more permanent.
Yes. And with the drugs, they found that you had to kind of continually dose yourself or find yourself kind of back in the land of the mundane, whereas yoga was a safe and free and available, always available way of kind of transforming your consciousness.
I can remember Ram Dass tell a story, and you recount it in your book, Stephanie Simon, in the book The Subtle Body, And the story where he gives his guru in India, well, the guru actually asks for some acid. And the guru takes something like, 14 times a normal dose, and nothing happens to him.
Yes. And in fact, it happened twice. Ram Dass, who at the time was still Richard Alpert, went to India pretty burnt out on psychedelic drugs, but in no way intending to give them up. And he brought a bunch of acid with him to India. And he was kind of commandeered in India by a young man named Kermit Riggs, who many people know as Bhagwan Dass now. And Bhagwan Dass takes him up to his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, up in the hills. And at some point, Neem Karoli Baba asks for the drugs. And Richard Alpert at the time is kind of racking his brain. He thinks this guy's an old guy, so maybe he wants a vitamin pill or some aspirin. You know, no one really knows his age, so he didn't immediately think of the acid. But he eventually understands that he wants the acid. So he hands him over a dose, and then Neem Karoli Baba asks for another and another until he gets to this incredibly high dosage of acid that would pretty much blow anyone's mind and make them crazy for a while. And he really nothing happens. He just sits there and he kind of messes with Ram Dass a little bit, but is completely himself. And this so impresses Ram Dass that it really changes his mind about the drugs. And then, and really starts to make them seem kind of irrelevant. And he kind of wants to understand how Neem Karoli Baba did it and what was going on there. And I don't know that he ever fully understands it, but a couple years later he goes back because he's convinced, he wants to be extra sure that this is what he had really witnessed and it wasn't just some trick of his memory. And kind of the scene is repeated and the message is impressed upon him that you don't need the drugs for these kind of spiritual realizations.
This whole relationship, and I think Ram Dass did have it with his guru, the relationship between the disciple and the guru. First, I'd like to ask you about maybe the positive aspect of that. You recount a story in a book of one person who was a reporter, a journalist, and who went to a meeting and did not expect at all to have any kind of religious conversion there and did. Tell us what happened and how. What is this experience?
Well, there were two people that kind of fit that description. One was Sally Kempton, who is a young journalist on the road to success. Her father's a famous journalist, Murray Kempton. She had been kind of experimenting with some other movements, but really had a bad marriage, was recently divorced, but was really kind of a rising star in journalism. And this was in the late 60s. And in the early 70s, she went to an event where Swami Muktananda was presiding. And she really just sat and listened to him and watched him. And she really didn't have much interaction with him beyond maybe the wave of a peacock feather over her. And she went home and she had these incredibly blissful experiences of floating, incredibly sensual experiences kind of. And she didn't totally understand them, but she knew she wanted more. And so she went back and she continued to have these engulfing experiences where she just felt herself expand to time, take in the universe. And the more she spent time with Muktananda, the more she felt this way. And the explanation typically given is that Muktananda had this ability to awaken Kundalini in people almost spontaneously. So rather than go through the arduous and years-long process of learning to control the energies of the subtle body and raise the energies from the bottom chakra to the top with a touch of the wand or just being around him could have that experience, you know, could elicit this experience in his devotees or people who became his devotees. And there was another, Paul Zweig, who had a very similar experience. He was a writer in New York and kind of went to visit Muktananda as a favorite friend and found himself completely kind of overwhelmed and unhinged in a very good way and had this incredibly buoyant energy. And he was told by another disciple that was Shaktipat, that he was touched in a way, not physically, but by Muktananda, that had, in a way that just had kind of completely awakened Kundalini at one go.
You've done yoga for a long time, is that right?
That's true.
Do you believe in this Shaktipat? And what is it? How does it happen?
I believe it's possible. It does seem that Muktananda did have a lot of people had that, he had that effect on many people, and it was fairly well documented. I think it could, that explanation that it's the awakening, a spontaneous awakening of Kundalini could well be true. you know, and it's an intensely subjective experience. So it's hard for me to comment on it. And certainly someone like Paul Zweig was quite skeptical to begin with. I mean, he was certainly searching in that moment of his life, but he was not particularly biased towards Muktananda in any way. And so I believe he did have some very powerful spiritual energy about him. But I think many, many people could have contact with him or practice yoga for long periods of time and not have this experiencing, because I think some people are kind of disposed to the awakening of Kundalini quite readily, other people less so. I mean, it's like anything else. Some people have to plod along for a long time and really don't get very far. You know, I think there's a propensity for sort of spiritual realizations, just as people are sort of more adept physically in some ways or, you know, musically.
And this kind of an experience, the relationship between the disciple and the guru awakened a real devotion, almost a kind of love affair is what you call it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. In the case of Sally Kempton, she pretty much dedicated 20 years of her life to Muktananda and his organization once he passed away. And she just kind of picked up with almost no money in her pocket and moved into his ashram in the Catskills at a time when his following was pretty small, growing, but still small. And she just felt that she wanted to be at the source of that feeling. And Muktananda was the source. And she, I think, quite happily and, you know, with no regrets at this point, really oriented her life completely around Muktananda's organization and yoga, essentially. Other people have different relationships to their guru. That hers was, I think, the one of the more clear example of a real devotion, a kind of almost unblemished devotion to a guru. You know, someone like Ram Dass, I mean, he was certainly devoted to Neem Karoli Baba, but he was in India and Ram Dass was here most of the time. He spent some time being devoted to some other teachers and having some bad experiences. And in fact, he became very devoted to a woman named Joya Santana, and became kind of her spiritual partner. And it was kind of a intense but brief relationship because it kind of spun out of control. And he eventually felt that his devotion to her was misplaced and that he had been kind of taken in by some of her theatrics. And he distanced himself from her and really saw it as an instance of the dangers of this sort of total reverence to one's guru.
Stephanie Simon, author of The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America. We'll talk more after the break. Back to Writer's Voice, I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Stephanie Simon about how yoga came to America and the many ways Americans have viewed it and practiced it. Before the break, we were speaking of the relationship between the guru and his or her devotees. Many yoga practitioners say the guru-disciple relationship is essential for truly learning the practice, but it can also lead to abuses. There are many cases, Yogi Bhajan and others, in which the seamier side of the devotional relationship, the abusive, comes to the fore. And I'd like to ask you, what's that about?
I think ultimately what you have is the root fact that these swamis and gurus, however spiritually powerful, they were still men and they were still fallible. And they had not transcended the usual temptations of power, and those include being able to sexually prey on younger women and access to a lot of money, which can then be used for ill in all sorts of ways, some positive, many not so positive. So I think ultimately the relationship with one's guru, you always have to balance the reverence for their spiritual powers and gifts and the fact that they are still human beings and not above any of the human foibles. I think that I've read Indian commentators have a very kind of down to earth approach to gurus, which is, oh, we listen to 50% of what the guru says and 50% we throw out. I think in America, we're kind of extreme. Either we reject the very idea of a guru as man worship or dangerous, inherently dangerous, or we kind of take up the mantle of the devout disciple without reservation. And I think there's kind of a more of a middle ground. The history of spiritual practice is rife with just these sorts of abuses of power. And in almost every single organization in America, these sorts of abuses were front and center. But they're not limited to the American gurus, by the way, by any means. I mean, there are gurus in India. There are all sorts of scandals. So, you know, I think it speaks to the difficulty of transcending the usual human limitations, no matter how intense your spiritual practice. And I think in a way the gurus are more vulnerable, because if you're just off in your corner quietly practicing and not held up by the rest of the world as an exemplar of anything, it's probably easier to resist temptation. But these men were, essentially they had access. They had the means. It was easier for them to prey upon others because they had so much power.
In The Subtle Body, Stephanie Simon writes about Bikram Chowdhury, who's achieved huge financial success selling yoga retail through classes and their franchise, rather than depending on the largest of disciples. But Chowdhury is noteworthy for another reason as well.
I find Bikram is also interesting, though, because of the way in which his success is kind of predicated on a type of yoga which is so physically demanding. It requires a level of devotion that is kind of similar to the devotion that we saw in the 60s and 70s with the gurus, which is not to say that people move into ashrams to practice Bikram yoga, but they certainly dedicate an awful lot of their time to it and have to restructure their lives often to afford them the time to practice Bikram yoga, because it's not a practice that you can take lightly. It's the one that's done in a hot room. It's a 90-minute practice. You can't do that once or twice a week comfortably. You have to be there pretty much 5 days, 6 days a week. And thousands of Americans do this every day.
And talk a little bit about how that happened. I mean, I can remember when yoga was something that you did for your health and for fitness, but it was something that ordinary human beings could do. And it seems like it's morphed into something that, you know, I know that I've stopped doing yoga because it seems to me when I go to classes, I always injure myself.
What happened? There was sort of a decline of yoga, and the two factors inform this, and then there was a resurgence. And the decline was partly the result of the gurus and swamis being discredited because so many had abused their power, and partly because yoga, the hatha yoga, the physical yoga, the more physically oriented yoga being taught, was really marketed as gentle and relaxing and refreshing. And when fitness culture changed, that kind of yoga, which was kind of seen as exercise, couldn't compete. So when aerobics came on the scene and jazzercise and jogging in the really late 70s and early 80s, yoga just kind of got displaced by these other forms of exercise. And while we know yoga, again, has a different purpose, ultimately, it really had taken its place in American fitness culture. So when the early 90s, a kind of yoga, including Bikram yoga, two kinds of yoga became much more popular. And this kind of yoga could compete with these more strenuous forms of exercise. And that included Bikram yoga and Ashtanga yoga as taught by Patabi Joyce. And that's the very flowing yoga, which is very physically demanding. And so it was the very fact that these forms were so physically demanding and could essentially compete with aerobics and jazzercise and jogging that essentially prompted the resurgence in the early 90s, because all of a sudden people were taking notice and feeling like, oh, well, I don't have to jog anymore. That's killing my knees. I can practice yoga. And you saw, again, a lot of men coming and discovering yoga and actually talking about it and talking about it in a way that made it very clear that this stuff was tough. You know, this was macho yoga. And I think that really spurred its revival.
So ultimately, what do you see as America's contribution to yoga yoga having, of course, contributed so much now to America. What is so uniquely American about the yoga that you talk about in your book?
Well, again, there are so many yogas. I mean, I think what's unique about our approach to it is we're really, again, kind of democratic. We've really taken up so many different forms and created viable organizations out of so many of them. I mean, you know, Swami Satchananda was, again, propounded a more holistic kind of yoga, included some of the poses, but really was more meditative, and he still has a very large organization, though he passed away years ago. And you can find integral yoga centers around. Shivananda Yoga, which did include the poses, but was also a lot more focused on meditation and devotion and a sort of lifestyle. There are many Shivananda Yoga centers around. So, you know, many kinds of yoga still thrive. I mean, certainly in this latest incarnation, America, I think, is famous for turning hatha yoga into business, one that's largely based on the poses and maybe some breathing exercises, but really this sort of reductive, very secularized yoga's physical fitness. For better or for worse, that yoga is prevalent and here to stay. But I do think the fact that so many people get involved in that form of yoga does kind of, it is ultimately a gateway to yoga as a bigger, richer experience.
Stephanie Simon, thanks so much for talking with Writer's Voice. Your book is The Story of Yoga in America, The Subtle Body.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stephanie Simon practices yoga in New York City. Her work has appeared in The Wall Street Journal, Rolling Stone, Vogue, and Yoga Journal. Next up, we delve into the WikiLeaks controversy and what it bodes for press freedom and the freedom of the Internet.
But what I really learned in the last 3 years is that a difference can be made bottom-up and not only top-down.
Information does not respect borders. States are going to have to rethink how they approach information. Any state which fails to do this will cease to exist.
Well, you know, if we're going to have a military and a defense policy, it's predicated on having information that is controlled. Of course, we're a democracy. We're one of the most open countries, I believe, in the history of the world. But information has to be protected in certain circumstances and denied to the public.
Democracy without transparency is no democracy. I mean, that's just an empty word.
That's a clip from the Swedish TV documentary WikiLeaks Rebels. The intention of WikiLeaks, according to spokesman Julian Assange, is to use the power of the Internet to promote transparency and thereby support greater democracy. Whether you think WikiLeaks is a good thing or a bad thing, it has lifted the veil on the real workings of governments, workings that, had citizens known about them earlier, might have forewarned us about some of the quagmires we're finding ourselves in, like the war in Afghanistan. In this, it may signal a shift in the balance of power between governments and the grassroots. WikiLeaks has been able to do this for the moment, but that moment may be brief. In a world where the crises from war to climate change are ever more dangerous, the efforts of governments to punish those who would reveal secrets to the people are increasing in ferocity. And it's not just governments. How far have we come from the rule of law when calls for Julian Assange's assassination are applauded and copied among the press and pundits instead of condemned? Barack Obama is a constitutional lawyer. He should defend the right of freedom of speech, yet his administration is looking to throw the book at Julian Assange and get Congress to pass laws that can prosecute him if they don't now exist. And what about the pressure government is bringing to bear on private corporations who control our access to information on the Internet? Do we really want PayPal, Amazon, and Facebook to be the ones to decide what's acceptable social protest and what's not? So what will WikiLeaks mean for press freedom and the freedom on the Internet? Later on, we'll hear from Nation columnist Alexander Coburn. But first, I asked Tim Carr of the media reform group Free Press, what does government's attempt to silence WikiLeaks say about emerging threats to a citizen's right to know?
It's an amazing phenomenon, but it doesn't feel as though it is something that has come out of the blue. I think anybody who has been watching the way governments treat privileged information historically know that it was they were heading on a collision path with the internet. And WikiLeaks is just a glaring example of that, where you now have an individual who has access to privileged information, an organization that has access to privileged information. In the most recent case, State Department cables on international affairs coming out of embassies all around the world, who makes this information public and has now felt the full force. Well, probably not the full force yet, but a very powerful reaction from one of the most powerful governments in the world. And I think what is particularly interesting and even worrying from the perspective of Free Press, that does a lot of work on this, is the amount of collusion that we have seen coming from corporations, collusion between government and very powerful corporations. WikiLeaks' website was yanked from its server. The PayPal service that they were using to raise money was closed down. And these were all actions taken by corporations, taken by companies that control web hosting services and payment services, basically at the behest of the U.S. government. And so you see this kind of collusion happening now, and it's, and again, this is, there is a history of this. If you go back to 2007 and 2008, you'll find that you remember the whole controversy surrounding FISA, wiretapping of telephone conversations by phone companies without legal warrant. There was a very large controversy late in the Bush administration where companies like AT&T and Verizon were allegedly tapping phone conversations without getting legal warrant under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So what's happening with WikiLeaks is very much a part of that trend, and it's something that I think we need to be very vigilant about, because governments are over-exercising their power to stifle what is essentially free speech.
Tim Carr, you're saying, in effect, that on the one hand, governments are attacking the privacy of individuals and recruiting companies to help it do that. And on the other hand, government is shutting down attempts by individuals or non-government organizations to make government more transparent and recruiting corporations to do that.
Yeah, and I don't know how overt this is, pressure has been applied, whether these powerful corporations are doing this in and of their own volition, or whether they're getting direct communications from the government to close down WikiLeaks' website, to close down its payment service, where, you know, at some point WikiLeaks might leak information about how this all unfolded. But I think what you have, anybody who spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. or close to government, you realize that there's a sort of cult of secrecy that pervades Washington, and there's a lot of power that comes with having information. In many ways, a lot of power comes from withholding information from others, and the State Department and others have been criticized for being overly secretive. And what you're seeing with WikiLeaks is, I think, in many ways, a backlash to that cult of secrecy, where they're saying, you know, this some of this stuff that is being done in the name of U.S. taxpayers, but oftentimes without their consent or even knowledge, is things that should be made more transparent. And so it's interesting how it has divided so many people in the United States. And for some, this is not a question of free speech, but more a question of national security. And the debate that has raged over the last several weeks has been pretty instructive, very interesting, and interesting to see how certain players fall out as to their position on this.
Is a security issue being used to defend not national security, but the power of states to protect secrets?
Yes, in many ways it is. I mean, again, information is a very powerful thing, and as is withholding information from others. And I think, you know, a lot of the accusations that have been thrown at WikiLeaks over the last weeks have actually turned out to be untrue. There is a sense that that WikiLeaks has been recklessly making information public in ways that endangered the lives of certain individuals who are working as informants for the U.S. government overseas and things like that. And as, you know, as it's turned out, and at least from my understanding of the way publications like the New York Times and the Guardian and others have used this information, it has been a fairly thorough vetting process in collaboration with WikiLeaks to make sure that those sorts of harms to individuals and others are handled carefully, that certain information that could bring harm to individuals has been redacted from a lot of these files, and that the information that we're getting for the most part is really about the sort of secrets that the government has been keeping from us, secrets like military operations in Yemen that the U.S. government said it wasn't involved with, for example, that I think is important. These are important issues. The way that certain suspects, Al-Qaeda suspects, have been sent overseas to other nations where they are subsequently tortured and in some cases killed, you know, this is important information. This is a fundamental human rights issue. There's issues of international policy and violations of law that I think American citizens have the right to know about. So while a lot of the material has been characterized as being somewhat, you know, immaterial or you know, simply gossip, I think there are other points to WikiLeaks and information in these cables that is truly important. So it's been very controversial the way these have been handled and the ways these have come out, but at the end of the day, I think it's a good thing that people know what's being done in our name. And so it's been interesting. And obviously we have yet to, you know, they still say that we've only seen the tip of the iceberg, but there's much more information that is going to be made public. There's information not only about government secrets, but WikiLeaks has indicated that there's going to be an upcoming release of information related to the Bank of America and other financial institutions and the ways that they were handling mortgage defaults and all of that, which is also critical information about the private sector that has direct bearing on our economy. So this is a story that's not going to end soon, and I think the conversation that's happening around it right now is actually healthy for our democracy and healthy for Americans.
The WikiLeaks release of the embassy cables gave rise to a pushback from the U.S. government, getting MasterCard, PayPal, and the others to disconnect supporters from those sites. And that pushback has now led to a payback from supporters of WikiLeaks against those companies. With these battle lines being drawn up on the Internet, does this bode well or ill for the future of openness on the web?
Well, we're seeing a kind of cyber warfare, but it's not warfare in the traditional sense. Here we have concerned citizens or concerned WikiLeaks supporters who have the technical means to do things, hitting back against some of these corporations that have attempted to close down WikiLeaks. And so you're seeing online right now a kind of battle between citizen activists and corporate powers. And so, I mean, I think you'll have social scientists, political science, political historians, you know, looking at what's going on right now for decades, and it may be just the beginning of something where we have these sort of loose-knit multinational groups, groups like 4chan, which is a somewhat nefarious collaboration of online individuals who have the capacity via their high-speed internet connection and via the social networks that they've built online to actually attack institutions in ways that may not cause physical harm, but certainly cause financial harm, and send a very powerful message about, you know, who really controls the internet and who really has power over information.
Tim Carr of Free Press, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
First you told us only through you could we know God, and if we dared to question, he wouldn't spare the rod. For you we worked the soil, for you we dug the moors, for you we shed our blood and fought so many pointless wars. And now you try to tell us there's nothing we can do. You say the world around us belongs fairly to the few, but about 6 billion people no doubt will agree this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would enclose the land all around the earth, our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain.
Alexander Coburn has been a journalist since the early 1970s. He edits the political newsletter Counterpunch and writes the Nation column Beat the Devil. His recent article on WikiLeaks in that column spurred me to call him up to get more of his take on the WikiLeaks phenomenon.
Well, I think what WikiLeaks has been doing, not just in the three very famous sets of disclosures of the last few months, but over, you know, recent times, is good. But we live in a society, you know, obsessed with secrecy. The state is steadily trying to make more and more things secret which shouldn't be secret at all. And WikiLeaks has, of course, been challenging that. And the cables that it got on Iraq and Afghanistan, including, of course, the famous film of the Apache helicopter murdering journalists and ordinary people in Baghdad, has been very important because it's completely contradicted the pretensions of the U.S. military and of the U.S. State Department and of the U.S. government. And that's to be applauded. That's the job of journalism. And so they're doing a job of journalism which many so-called journalists in the mainstream press, in CNN, in ABC, in NBC, and so forth, haven't been doing at all. And, of course, the very latest one, which has caused this most enormous fuss, is, again, admirable, because most of the cables are not of extreme secrecy. In fact, 2.5 million people had authorization to read those cables. They can't be actually deadly secrets, really. 2.5 million people is a lot of people. So that's all to the good. What it has shown is something that, again, people have been aware of for quite some time, which is how extremely vulnerable our mainstream means of communication these days, in other words, the Internet, is open to government censorship and interdiction. In the column I just did for The Nation, I drew attention to the fact that in 1967, when Ramparts magazine, which actually finally morphed into Mother Jones magazine, which you probably know it as, they published details of the secret way in which the CIA had been using the National Students Association as a front organization. There was an enormous fuss. The CIA authorized dirty tricks operations against Ramparts. The FBI conducted what's called a full court investigation. At no time did the government actually try and march people into the offices and close it down, because they knew, of course, there'd be a First Amendment challenge. Particularly with print materials, you go in and try and close a press down, there are, you know, the first constitutional rights to free speech. That was then. About 2 years later, in 1973 or so, a CIA case officer called Philip Agee actually left the agency and then went to England and arranged to write a Penguin book called Inside the Company, which was the first really major detailed disclosure of what a CIA officer does. Both of these enterprises had more secrets in them than what WikiLeaks has divulged. But in both cases, I mean, if it had been today, of course, seeing what's happened to Assange and WikiLeaks, the CIA would have been closing down all electronic business of Ramparts. It would have been threatening Penguin Books, which did publish Agee's book in 1975. Amazon would have immediately not featured it on Amazon, which would have been a death blow for the book. And it just highlights the difference between what's happened now. And in WikiLeaks, you know, they've now, what have they done? This collusion of government and commercial enterprise, they've closed WikiLeaks, although, of course, there are, what, over 1,000 mirror sites now. They've managed to get Visa and MasterCard to cancel their credit card business. They've persuaded Amazon, of course, not to be a host to them. They've persuaded the Swiss bank no longer to honor their accounts. And they're gone. Now, there was no courtroom hearing. There was no challenge. There's no way WikiLeaks can go back into court with any possibility of mounting an illegal challenge. So this is what we face.
Is this a new development? Is freedom of the content on the Internet now subject to the whims of private companies that are hosting that content?
Totally. Totally. State and private, both. Or a mix of the two. State operating on behalf of the private people carrying out what the state wants them to do. And the moment we've got, you know, the Internet, which should be a public electronic commons, you know. It is being steadily privatized. And people don't really realize the dangers. A lot of people, let's say they're on Facebook. Soon Facebook will be running its email. Everything they do on Facebook will be through Facebook portals. So supposing suddenly they want to access material Facebook doesn't care for, or government has told Facebook it doesn't support, those people will be trapped inside Facebook without being able to find out what's going on. So it's a great plus that WikiLeaks was able to take advantage of, you know, lax security and their knowledge of how the net works. That's good to expose this huge, huge, insane government secrecy, which is supported and connived at by many journalists and institutions, by the way. And on the other hand, the ease with which the government can strike back. That's a very big crisis for anybody interested in democratic communication.
What are you seeing is the response of journalists to WikiLeaks?
Well, it's mixed. I mean, some journalists are doing their duty and seeing this as a great opportunity, and other journalists are very nervous and cautious, like the New York Times. You know, in the second WikiLeaks dump, the big one about the Afghanistan, I think it was, a few months ago, you know, they on the one hand, they use some of the WikiLeaks material, actually from The Guardian. On the other hand, they wrote very nasty attacks on Assange. So they were like having their cake and eating it too. And in this one now, they keep asserting how everything has been scrutinized, made sure that nobody's, you know, going to be compromised, no real security. And WikiLeaks actually has cooperated with this, you know. Already a lot of probably excessive filtering going on. So it again, and then you get really, you know, traitors to the profession, such as the guy on CNN, you know.
Is that Wolf Blitzer?
Yeah, Wolf Blitzer, you know, screaming for more secrecy.
Do you think that the government is going to go after the press organs, like the New York Times and the others that have revealed the WikiLeaks content? Do you think this is going to open things up or close things down?
Well, if the government feels it can push and not get a pushback, it'll get more and more demanding. It's already told people that no one who hopes to work for the government or the State Department should even look at WikiLeaks online. Senator Lieberman has said the Times itself may have broken the laws, and that anybody who's actually saved a WikiLeaks document is by definition committing a breach of the espionage laws or whatever it is. So they'll go on doing this until some voice of sanity intervenes. Of course, Congress, as always in these national security scares, most of them, you know, are only too eager to sit down and write new emergency laws, just like they did with the Patriot Act and so forth. When these people panic, you know, the results are always bad.
I asked Coburn, what can people do to protect Internet democracy?
Well, there's a number of avenues that can be creative technologically. They seem very knowledgeable, but there's got to be a push. I mean, it sounds very unpromising in the current context to strengthen constitutional freedoms and, you know, the right to have a hearing and to contest a government challenge to remove your website. What we can't have now is, effectively, you're taken away in the middle of the night and shot. Your site is just gone. It's like, you know, you're hauled off to the gulag. That's it. Goodbye. And that's a very, very dangerous and very menacing.
Alexander Coburn. In addition to his column in The Nation, he co-edits Counterpunch and has authored numerous books. You can find a link to his Nation piece on writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.